Welcome back to Interchain FM, your source for tech on the bleeding edge of cryptocurrency. We find the newest research ideas being developed in the blockchain industry, interviewing people and projects who are pioneering the breakthroughs of the future. Interchain FM is hosted by myself, Chango Unchained, and co-hosted with Christopher Goes. This week on Interchain FM, we have Riyad Wabi joining us to discuss a particular zero-knowledge proof called Goosig. Riyad is a PhD student at Stanford University who works with Dan Bonet, Christopher Jeffrey, and Joseph Poon using Goosig to enable a privacy-preserving token distribution scheme for the Handshake naming system. Riyad, can you briefly give us an introduction about yourself so that our listeners know who you are and what you do and what you do in relation to the crypto space?
Sure. Hi, I'm Riyad Wabi. I'm a PhD student at Stanford. I work with Dan Bonet and Keith Winstein and sometimes David Gonzalez. And, you know, most of my work is sort of in the general vicinity of proof systems, probabilistic proof systems, you know, SNARKs and zero-knowledge proofs and this sort of thing. Recently, I've been working with Dan and some folks at Handshake on a project that we call Goosig or private airdrops.
I've been hyping up Goosig a lot, and I think there's enough interest in the ecosystem for people to know a little bit more about what it is, what it does, and why it's sort of important in the context of, you know, doing privacy-preserving airdrops and how we could help with initial token distributions through this scheme.
Sure. Well, I'm glad to hear that you're excited about it. And we're pretty excited about it, too. So the thing that got us kind of started thinking about this was really it was a conversation with some of the same folks who ended up making Handshake. And it, really, the worry was something like this. You know, if we want to do an airdrop, it might be that, you know, some of the people who want to claim the airdrop funds, for whatever reason, I mean, look, people have very reasonably, you know, an expectation that like they should get some privacy. And yet, most of the time when you claim an airdrop, you're sort of telling the whole world that, yes, I took some money from this, you know, brand new currency and who knows, you know, anything about them. Unfortunately, what that means is that you've tied some existing identity online to this new currency. And that's kind of indelible, even if the currency supports, you know, the standard kind of privacy-preserving stuff, you know, secret transactions and anonymous payments and stuff like this. The act of claiming in the first place usually is going to use some existing private key or public key that you own. And so the claim, you know, sort of intrinsically ties the identity on the new chain to the old existing public key. And so this was the problem that we started from, this idea that, well, we should be able to do airdrops in a privacy-preserving way. And so that's what Goosig let us do.
Instead of proving that you own the private key corresponding to a specific public key, what are you proving? Are you proving that you know the private key corresponding to one public key in some set, but not which one?
Kind of. Yeah, you can think about it that way, except that here the set is basically all existing private keys. You could think about it as sort of a kind of like a group signature, which is what you've alluded to, and maybe we can come back to the specific definition of that later. Or you can think about it as sort of the person who sets up the airdrop is effectively generating a new, like a brand new credential for you, but that credential is tied to the secret that you already have from an existing public key. They can generate a new key for you in a way that the only person who can sort of use that key, the only person who has the secret is you, because you're the only one who has the secret to the old key. So this is something that's related to like hierarchical deterministic signatures, which is, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with those. That's a way of essentially deriving a new public key and corresponding private key from an existing key pair. And for, you know, elliptic curve based signature schemes, HD signatures essentially work. I mean, there are little technical details, but like you can basically think of the hierarchical deterministic wallets as being effectively all you need for a private airdrop for elliptic curve signatures. Things get a little more complicated if you want to use RSA keys to do airdrops. And you might say, well, that sounds crazy. Nobody cares about RSA keys anymore. And maybe we wish that were the case, but well, still, if you're using, you know, GitHub, or if you have a website and you have some, you know, secret associated with, say, your SSH key, most of the time that's going to be an RSA key, just because like SSH key gen defaults to RSA. or, you know, PGP key, same thing. So a lot of people do have RSA keys. There's tons of them out there. And it would be nice if we could use those to do the private airdrops or to do private airdrops and goose eggs. And that's where kind of the problem comes in, because there's no obvious way of doing it that's the analog of HD wallets.
Another element you care about in the use case of a private airdrop is that each person can individually claim once, or you want some kind of linkability, like linkable ring signatures, maybe, so that you can prevent two claims by the same, you know, GitHub identity. Is that right? How do you achieve that?
In fact, you might want a couple different things there. So clearly, as you say, you know, we want it to be the case that, like, once you've claimed once, you don't get to claim again. But you might actually ask for a little more, because let's say I want to airdrop to, you know, a bunch of people on GitHub. A lot of people on GitHub actually have many keys associated with their account, and in some cases, like dozens of them, right? And so it would be really nice if we could say, well, you can claim with any of your keys, but once you've claimed, no matter which key you use, all of them now are voided. So you can't, just because you have 10 keys on GitHub doesn't mean you should get to claim 10 times. So this is another sort of little piece of mechanism that we describe in Kusig's paper.
Let's go deep into the weeds.
So since we're talking about it, let's talk about how this idea of sort of making, doing one claim and having it void all of your possible claim keys works. Actually, this is sort of based on a very nice old idea called a Merkle signature. So essentially, I think most of us are familiar with Merkle trees. You know, the leaves of the tree are something. In this case, let's say the leaves of the Merkle tree are public keys. And then we compute the root of the tree from the leaves in the standard way by hashing. And so now what we can, and then that's the public key. The root of the tree is the public key. So we've gone from a bunch of keys that live in the leaves to one new key, which is just the root of a Merkle tree. And now if I want to give you a signature, all I have to do is produce some leaf of the tree, which is, say, a public key, and then a valid Merkle path to the root, and then a signature under the key that was in the leaf. Right. So imagine that, you know, I had an RSA key in one of the leaves and I know the corresponding secret. So I send you a signature under the RSA key. I send you the RSA key, the public key itself, and I send you a path from the leaf to the root. And then you can check all of those, right? It's easy to check the signature using the RSA signature algorithm, and it's easy to check the Merkle path using hashing. And then once that's done, now you can just mark the root of the tree as burned, and that invalidates automatically all of the keys associated with any leaf in the tree. So this means, like, you know, there might have been 100 leaves in the tree, which means I can sign with any of 100 different keys. But as soon as you see that there's a key corresponding to the root, then, there's a path to the root, rather, then you strike the root off your list of valid keys, and I'm no longer allowed to sign, even if I have 127 more keys.
And you could nest this, presumably, if you wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely. You've intuited already the next step, which is, now imagine that we have like a million people and we want to be able to have we want to be able to airdrop to all million people, right? So for each person, we generate one of these Merkle signature trees, and then their airdrop key is the root of that tree. And then we generate one huge Merkle tree whose leaves are all of the Merkle signature roots for each person. So now we have a tree with a million leaves, and each leaf is itself a Merkle root. And then we compute the root of the big Merkle tree, and then we can just sort of store that thing in the genesis block of a new currency, say, a new chain. And then if somebody wants to prove that they're allowed to claim an airdrop, well, they have to give you a signature that corresponds to their Merkle root, which means they have to give you, say, an RSA signature and a path. And then they have to give you a path from their Merkle root to the global Merkle root. And now you know that they are a valid claimer of some airdrop. But what this means nicely is we don't have to write down a million things in the genesis block. Mm-hmm. We only have to write down one thing. That is just the root of the Merkle tree. And, of course, you could recurse again. Maybe that would even be a cool idea, although I've never thought about recursing more. But this is sort of a nice way of a reasonably intuitive way, I think, of compressing all this information into one nice, tidy Merkle root.
That makes sense. But so far, if I understand correctly, this is public. Yes, the user has to reveal the key they're signing with along with the paths.
Right. So we haven't talked about that part yet. Yeah. So far, as you say, everything that we talked about now assumes that there's a public key. So then the question is, how do we go from there to something that doesn't reveal the public key? And this is where sort of the real heavy lifting and goosing comes in. So again, I'm going to assume an RSA key, you know, in your head, you can replace this with sort of a description that works with sort of an HD wallet style derivation. But I think really the kind of interesting technical piece of it is the RSA piece. And also, you know, I can talk about it sort of in reasonably general terms. And so maybe the whole thing kind of makes sense as a template. So the idea here is, I said earlier, we want to have privacy preserving airdrops. But now the first question we should ask is, who is it private from? So in the ideal case, maybe there's some way that we could make it secret from everyone. Like, I send you an anonymous message and then you airdrop me one. But that's not exactly the model we were going after here. The model we were thinking about was more like the GitHub model, where you, as the person who's sending out the airdrop funds, you know that there's, you know, a million users on GitHub and you want to give them all money. And so you can get their public keys from GitHub. And now what you want to do is you want to send them money, but you don't want anyone else to learn who's claiming. So this is the model. So the person who's doing the airdropping, the person who's sending, knows all the public keys. And the recipient knows their own public key. And then anyone else can verify a claim without learning anything about who the actual people are. Okay, so how did that work? So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to have the sender for each key generate effectively a commitment to the key.
The sender of the airdrop. Remember,
yes, sorry, the sender of the airdrop, the person who's generating all the airdrop keys. I'll call them the sender, and I'll call the claimer maybe the recipient, and then anyone else will call a verifier. So we have three parties here, a sender, recipient, and verifier. And so the sender, let's say, is going to send an airdrop to Alice. So what the sender does is it takes Alice's public key and then essentially generates a commitment to the public key. So specifically in the case of RSA, remember, an RSA public key is effectively just a modulus. It's like some, you know, 2,000-bit number or 4,000-bit number that is the product of two primes. And then the secret is essentially the factorization of the two primes. So the sender is going to generate a commitment to the public modulus, to this 2,000-bit number. And in particular, he's going to use a Peterson commitment. And then that is sort of the public information. And so remember, a commitment, a cryptographic commitment, has sort of two nice properties. One is that it's hiding, which means that the commitment doesn't reveal what's inside. And the other is that it's binding, which means once I've generated a commitment to something, I can't change my mind and say, oh, what I really meant to say was this other thing. There's only one value that I can open the commitment to. If I try to cheat, you can catch me. So the sender commits to the public key and then publishes that commitment as the new key. And this commitment, since it's hiding, it doesn't reveal what's inside. It doesn't reveal, in particular, who, you know, the public modulus, and therefore it doesn't reveal who Alice is. But now Alice can prove that she knows the factorization of the number that's committed inside the commitment. You know, if she knows the factorization, then that must mean that she owns the secret, right? Because, again, the secret corresponding to an RSA key is exactly the factorization. I'm glossing over a little detail here, but that's, you know, morally equivalent. So then the question is, okay, how do we do this proof? And this is sort of the kernel of the technical piece. And that is essentially we write down kind of a new style of zero-knowledge proof. Well, new style, no. It's a new specific zero-knowledge proof in a kind of well-known style, I guess. And so the idea is it's a zero-knowledge proof of knowledge of the factorization of the integer that's hidden inside of the commitment. So the commitment is now sort of a new random public key. The secret is the same secret as always. It's the secret that, you know, you needed to sign under the original RSA key. It's just the factorization. And the signature really now is a zero-knowledge proof that you know what's inside the commitment and you know how to factor that thing. And here, you is the recipient. And then anyone can check that zero-knowledge proof, and they are convinced that, you know, if the proof is valid, that the person who generated the signature actually does know the corresponding secret, but they don't learn anything else. All they learn is the person did the right actions and must have known the right thing, and that's it.
To zoom out a little bit, why is it important that airdrops be private?
Oh, this is a great question. So this was sort of starting motivation was this observation that, well, you're kind of forever writing down and like publishing to the world that you're claiming an airdrop as soon as you do, right? Like You don't get to revoke that statement. And in fact, you can't even hide that statement, even if you, let's say, for example, you know, somebody starts a new cryptocurrency that's, you know, morally equivalent to like Zcash or something, where you can do private transactions. Even in that world, if I have to use my GitHub key to claim an airdrop, then there's sort of this indelible proof in the chain that I, the person who owns the GitHub key, has that I have some money associated with this new private blockchain. And then from there, I could do private transactions using the money that I got. That would be fine. Nobody would be able to follow the trail of the money. But still, somebody could look in the sort of early history of the chain and see, oh, this person claimed the money. It's like there's like this extra piece of privacy leakage for airdrops that's not there once you've got money on the chain. So this piece of it, especially for airdrops to keys that are sort of associated maybe with your professional career like GitHub, or, you know, keys that are associated, I mean, for example, you might consider airdropping to like the public key of like your website or something like this. Somehow those would be indelibly recorded in the blockchain. Well, that might make somebody nervous, right? You know, if my employer sees that I'm using my GitHub key to claim money, maybe they don't like that. Or, you know, if I claim money and then later it turns out that the blockchain I claimed from like got into some sort of trouble, maybe I don't like that. So, you know, for these reasons, we might want to keep our claim behavior secret. And up until now, there wasn't really a mechanism to do that.
How do you reason about airdropping keys to ones that are stored on secure hardware? We don't yet have programmable hardware that is able to decrypt or GUSI keys. And then for somebody who's keeping their keys in cold storage to then claim an airdrop, how do you reason around that?
That's a great question. For RSA, the answer is we don't actually have a solution to this right now. This is something that we're still kind of thinking about. I'll get into the reasons in a second, but essentially the high-level message here is if you have, you know, an RSA key stored like on your YubiKey, unfortunately, GUSIG as currently written doesn't work. For elliptic curve-based keys, the situation is slightly different. It basically depends on the signature algorithm, but in some cases, it's possible to do private airdrop-style signature for elliptic curve keys that are stored in hardware. And effectively, that is something very similar to like making a blind signature. So, I mean, I won't go into any more detail than that, but there are sort of techniques that are related to blind signatures that would work here. The reason for RSA keys that it doesn't quite work right now to sort of generate a claim message or to generate one of these zero knowledge proofs using a key that's stored in hardware is that, so I said earlier, the secret key corresponding to an RSA public key is the factorization of the RSA public key. That is almost true, but it's not quite true. So if you know the factorization of the modulus, then you definitely have the secret. It's actually possible to store slightly less information than that, I shouldn't say slightly less. It's not obvious that it's slightly less information, but you can store a slightly different piece of information. So this is nerdy detail, but so an RSA public key really is the RSA modulus and then some public exponent. And so when we encrypt to an RSA key, we sort of take some integer, raise it to the public exponent mod the modulus. The secret that's needed for decryption is the inverse of the public exponent mod the order of the multiplicative group mod the modulus. In particular, this is like phi of n or some, which is to say like Euler's totient function of n, the modulus. So if n is equal to p times q, then we have like inverse of e, the public exponent, mod p minus 1 times q minus 1. That is the actual secret that you need in order to decrypt an encrypted RSA message, and similarly for signatures. And so you can see how, well, if you know p and q, then you can easily compute e inverse mod p minus 1 times q minus 1. But if you know, so like on a piece of hardware, usually what it actually stores is the multiplicative inverse, and then actually also P and Q, because you can make the operations faster if you know P and Q. But unfortunately, the hardware doesn't let you sort of do arbitrary operations with the secret key. It only lets you, say, do signatures with the secret key. And unfortunately, that's not quite enough to generate a GUSIG, one of these zero-knowledge proofs for GUSIG. So you actually kind of need access to the secret key that usually the hardware doesn't give you. Now, in principle, we could implement, like on a smart card or something like this, goose-egg signing in the zero-knowledge proof style, where the smart card stores P and Q. It's capable of doing the math that you need. I haven't yet sat down and written. Usually these Java cards are most easily programmed in Java, unfortunately. I haven't actually sat down and written the Java code to like generate goose-egg proofs on like a smart card or something like this.
There's a large enough airdrop, someone could write it themselves in principle, right?
For sure. I think it wouldn't be super challenging. I mean, obviously, you say that, and then, of course, always implementing crypto is challenging. But I think most of the operations that you need in order to generate this signature are things that the smart card already supports natively and, well, unless the smart card is buggy, should support in a pretty secure way. So this is something where it shouldn't be, like, you know, an extremely challenging thing to implement on a Java card. That said, of course, implementing crypto, as I said, is never simple, so I'm not going to try and minimize the effort there. In the future, I hope to find some time to do that. I've actually been messing around with, you know, Java card programming for other reasons recently, and it, you know, it seems like this is something that I might try to find time to do in my spare time.
When is GooseSig going to be published?
Ah, great question. I had hoped we would already e-print it now, but unfortunately, it's not quite e-printed yet. I'm hopeful that in the next week or two, so certainly by the end of 2019, we'll have submitted it to the e-printing service, and then it'll appear in the proceedings at Financial Crypto 2020, which takes place, I think, middle of February. So I believe the FC20 website will also have some version of it up by late January, is my guess. But certainly, it'll be available from e-print. It'll be available before then, let's say.
And FC 2020 is going to be happening in Malaysia next year?
I think it's the second week of February, which I'm kind of grateful that they put it at that time, because it seems like that's not the most expensive time to get to Malaysia, although you could imagine it's still very expensive to get to Malaysia. but it seems like it'll be kind of a cool thing. This is something that probably some folks will be familiar. Joe Bonneau, who's a professor at NYU and also sort of very... you know, he's done a lot of work in blockchain. He's one of the program committee chairs. And I believe Nadia Henninger is the other chair. And they've done a great job of getting stuff organized. It looks like it'll be a very cool conference.
How many blockchain-based cryptographers are going to be there presenting applications in blockchain?
Oh, this is a great question. I think the website, if it doesn't already, it will soon have a list of the accepted papers. This year, I think this is the first year that they're doing this. They actually have a blockchain-specific track. So there will be like a blockchain paper at all hours of the day while the conference is going on. And like I said, I think this is the first year that they're doing the blockchain track, but really FC is like aiming to become the kind of premier blockchain-related crypto conference. And a lot of people I know submitted there. So, you know, I know offhand, like, you know, half a dozen papers or so that'll be there, but I'm sure it's sort of dozens of papers that'll be presented. So it seems like it should be exciting. And I know at some conferences they do like simulcast on YouTube. I'm not sure if that'll be set up this time. And maybe things aren't quite to that level yet of sophistication. But, you know, the hope is that these talks will become available soon after the conference, if they're not, you know, during. So I think it'll be kind of a nice resource. There should be some really cool work there.
Yeah, actually, I see on their website that Protocol Labs and Tezos, Chainalysis, IOHK, and even Blockstream are sponsoring Financial Crypto. Is this your first foray into blockchain application with the cryptography research you've been doing?
So blockchain-specific stuff, yeah. I mean, a lot of my prior work, I guess, is you know, broadly related to it, sort of in the, you know, more in like the technical details of zero-knowledge proof type stuff. But this one is sort of the first that's sort of very explicitly geared towards blockchain stuff. Another one of Dan's students, Alex, and I, and Dan, obviously, have been working recently on new work that's related to private sidechain. That should also be, I hope, e-printed in the next couple weeks. Happy to send you a link once it is. Another thing that Dan and I have worked on kind of recently is making BLS signatures more efficient. So BLS signatures are these pairing-based signatures. So they're very nice because they allow for like really simple threshold signatures and really nice like signature aggregation properties. And these can be useful for consensus protocols that are sort of gathering signatures from a bunch of verifiers and then letting people check the signatures very quickly later without taking sort of a ton of space.
We intend to add them to Tendermint. So a more efficient implementation would be fantastic. or more efficient theoretical model.
And actually there's also some pretty cool work like going on in the IETF, standardizing ELS signatures and the corresponding hashes to publish elliptic curves and stuff like this. And that's some stuff that Dan and I have also been involved in. I think all of this work is like super exciting. In general, I think it's sort of a great time to be thinking about cryptography because, you know, there's a lot of interest and like a lot of deployment going on that most of the people who were using cryptography 5 years ago were, either end users just sort of using TLS, or in my mind, the model is like, well, banks or something are deploying crypto. But now, like, there's a lot more interest, I think, in doing cutting edge stuff and deploying it quickly. And so, like I said, I think it's a great time to be a cryptographer and a great time to be in this area. It's super exciting.
Speaking of deployment, I wanted to ask, do you know what Handshake's plans are in deploying GooseApe? They plan to do that? Do you know when?
I have to admit, I'm not exactly sure what the timeline is, but this is something that, the plan, I believe, is to deploy in kind of the near future. And there's already public implementations of what Handshake plans to use, and they're going to do a big airdrop to GitHub users and I think the PGP strong set and maybe some other users as well, people who signed up. There are a bunch of categories of users and a lot of them have, you know, many keys. So this thing that we were talking about earlier with sort of claiming with any one of many keys, they're going to be using that. Yeah, so actually all of this implementation is up on the Handshake GitHub organization. And, you know, there's code there. People can take a look. It's kind of cool that all this development has been done in the open. Like the Handshake folks have done a great job with this.
Yeah, so I could actually speak a little bit to that. They've implemented GooseSig, and it's going to ship as soon as their mainnet launches. And I believe mainnet launch is basically whenever Handshake or HNSD reaches V1. And that's when the airdrop's going to happen for anyone who got HNS from the faucet, any GitHub developers who have just more than 15 or so followers. And anybody who owns a top-level domain who wants to redeem their domains on Handshake as well. I like their incentive mechanisms baked in because they give tokens to domain holders of existing TLDs, and then that's how they incentivize people to migrate over onto Handshake.
Super cool model. Super exciting. And just editorializing, they're doing a fantastic job, I think.
Yeah, I think they're really taking airdrops to the next level and trying to engage a community of actual engineers who aren't necessarily in the crypto ecosystem but could potentially be. I love everything that they're doing and what you guys are doing with GooseSig. So, and again, this is something that I'm really interested in implementing in Supernova, which is another airdropping chain. So for Supernova, since the thinking is for this chain to be sort of a prover chain, for it to be just serving proofs to clients. And by clients, I mean any blockchain or application that wants to airdrop tokens to like EC key holders, for example. EC key holders of Bitcoin, Handshake, Ether, Cosmos, these client chains would then use this Supernova chain, the Supernova prover chain, to then query people who've locked up tokens on any of the supported chains. And by supported chains, I mean Bitcoin, ETH, Cosmos, and Handshake. So yeah, in the future, Riyadh, GooseSig could be used on this other chain that's going to airdrop even more tokens to Handshake holders and Atom holders and Bitcoin holders and Ether holders.
I'd love to help that however I can with that. That's really cool. Supernova just sounds like, I'm sure that you've talked about it before, but I'm only learning about it very recently. You shared some documentation with me. I mean, it looks like it's going to be super valuable infrastructure.
Yeah, so the thinking is that people want to onboard existing communities, right? So the whole reason Handshake wants to airdrop to GitHub holders is because they want to onboard these people and financially incentivize them to build cool things on that protocol. Same goes for people who want token holders of Bitcoin, ETH, and Cosmos, because there's a lot of value in those communities. There's a lot of knowledge, a lot of skills that each of these new chains need. And so what's a better way of doing that than to financially incentivize them directly? And the way you could do that at a really high level in a really dynamic way is to use this sort of prover chain that sort of, it acts sort of like an oracle to all of these chains with people in it, with communities in it, like Cosmos. And then it serves proofs for when these people are engaged with this supernova chain. And by engagement, I mean people lock up tokens into time lock contracts or promise not to move them in a provable way. And then this chain just serves proofs that these people have done that. And then as a client chain, you can just like run an SPV to this chain that then is an oracle to four other chains. And so you as a client chain do not need to run full nodes and light nodes of each of those four chains. You just, all you have to do is just like query a proof.
Right. You can do this with the IBC interface.
Oh yeah.
The Supernova chain supports IBC, which I assume that it would, which will desugar to an SPV proof if it's a proof of work chain. I don't know if you've made decisions on that yet. To circle back a little bit to the crypto, Riyadh, I wanted to ask you what may be a tricky question. And that is, from a perspective of someone who is really deep in the mathematics, what do you think implementers, people who are working on applying cryptography to blockchains, get right? And what do you think they get wrong? How could we improve?
Oh, that's a really great question. So one thing that I think the community has done extremely well is, you know, one of the big mistakes that other cryptographic deployments have seen that we haven't really seen with cryptocurrencies, and I think for good reason, is people sort of doing stuff in secret, people like kind of rolling their own weird crypto and you know, not wanting any sort of opinion from, you know, the community or from cryptographers on, you know, what are good designs. In contrast to that, I think the cryptocurrencies communities have done a great job at this. You know, one of the things that you know, seems to be highly prized in many of these communities is sort of open development and, you know, advancing standards or at least sort of using existing knowledge and creating new knowledge that sort of builds on it and not sort of just like making up some wonky crap in a committee and then like hiding it from the world behind some paywall or something. That to me is like, this is the good model of deploying cryptography. And that part has been done, like, I think, extremely well. In addition to that, I think like at a lower level, like it's super impressive how much implementation work and how much like really high quality implementation work is being done in the cryptocurrency space. So this includes things from cross-language support for a lot of primitives. You know, you see everything from like JavaScript implementations to Java card implementations, which is like, that's a huge span in terms of technology. And like all of these things, you know, people are super interested in doing implementation. You see a lot of emphasis on sort of code quality and testing and things that, you know, you kind of expect and yet somehow used to be kind of the exception in cryptography implementation. So that to me is like super cool. And I think, you know, people have done a great job on that. I have a hope that in the future, the cryptocurrencies community will start moving in the way that to some limited extent we've started to see in like the broader cryptography community, which is towards like verified implementations. And I know this sort of sounds like, you know, anytime we talk about like, oh, we proved that the software is correct, maybe it starts to sound like a little bit loony. It's good and bad, right? Like somehow it's a very hard thing to do. But of course, it gives us like very strong assurances. The hard to do part, I think that's getting better. We're starting to see a lot more velocity in like the security and cryptography communities in terms of like actual implementations that are proved correct. So for example, like the MeTLS team has been working on like verifying like the TLS specification and the implementations of the specification. So that's like super exciting. And there have been, you know, sort of like at CCS this year, there were, you know, a few papers on, like there was a whole session on verified implementations. And I think that like this is the way we should be going. Like in the same way that, you know, we've moved, like cryptography in general has moved towards, you know, a very like rigorous kind of proof-based way of thinking about like security. I think like we should be extending that to the software level. And so what I would love to see is for the cryptocurrency community to start really getting on board with like verified implementations. And right now the tooling for this kind of thing is not great. And I, one of the things that I hope is that like with more interest, like there will be some drive to do more of this. This is not like a criticism, like nobody does this well right now, except like researchers, like some researchers, and like their work is extremely impressive. But I think, like, if we can, like, really start pulling this into the community in a big way, like, this would be a huge step forward in terms of, like, the level of assurance that we have that software is correct and, you know, just the general level of security for things like this. So to me, that's, like, the most exciting direction.
I have to say, it doesn't sound loony at all. As someone who has written code for what ended up being a production blockchain, having more formal proofs would have helped me sleep easier at night. But I wanted to dig a little bit into what tools do exist and maybe where you think implementers could start learning them or start help improving them. What are these researchers using? Are they using Coq or Ethereum Provers or...
Yeah, this is a great question. So actually, I'm going to take this opportunity to kind of plug a new ePrint that just came out, like, in the last, the last few days, maybe. And it is, like, a survey of existing, like, formal frameworks for doing, well, what they call computer-aided cryptography. So this is ePrint 2019/1393. And it's a systemization of knowledge paper that just came out, I think, a few weeks ago. And so this actually does a really good job, I think, of describing the state of the art right now. But to answer your question more directly, some of the things that we're starting to see are based sort of in the Coq style proofs, where it's sort of like a constructive proof. We start from foundations and get to like some like big formal statement, and then we can extract from that the corresponding formally verified software. And so an example of this, there's a project out of MIT. It's called Fiat Crypto, I believe is the name of the project. And I believe that is going into Boring SSL if it's not already. And this is exactly, as you said, based on Coq. This is a person who's a student of Adam Chitala at MIT. Super cool stuff. The other direction that's actually slightly different is, like, there's a tool called EasyCrypt. That is more in again, kind of an interactive theorem prover kind of thing. But this one is more based on or sort of geared towards making like these game style, crypto style art proofs, and then like writing software that corresponds to those. And so like at TCF this year, there was, for example, a paper on implementing like multi-party computation that is sort of proved correct. And they use EasyCrypt for this. These are like a couple different, slightly different styles, but overall, yeah, a lot of this sort of has that flavor of using theorem proving software. There is almost like if you think of that as a top-down approach, there's another school of bottom-up approach where essentially we can take existing software and prove properties about it. Again, I say we here, but like not me, like researchers who are sort of at the cutting edge can do this. And this is like related to areas that with the keywords to think about here are like symbolic execution programs. So the idea is like we can sort of understand the program text as like a set of constraints on the behavior of the computer. And then we can ask questions like, can the program ever result in this behavior? And this is a different style of proof, but it is something that is also useful for proving correctness. In this case, for sort of lower level, like bitwise operations kind of things. So this is another approach that I think is very promising. You know, if this is something that you're interested in, I would definitely recommend taking a look at this SOK. It's really, really a super cool paper, very nicely written and very accessible. Again, it's 2019/1393, and I can't recommend it enough, really. I think it's a great, very cool paper.
Thanks. For listeners, we'll put up links to all of the papers referenced in the notes so you can find them there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. I mean, just, I've had a great time. I will supply links to all of the things that I've forgotten off the top of my head. I'm sure there are many. And as soon as we have an ePrint up, obviously I'll send you a link to that too.
And for anybody who wants to dig into the implementation of Goosig, there is an existing one again on handshake.org. Their GitHub is live and open source. So, yeah, just be on the lookout. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.